This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The Cincinnati Opera is returning to its original home. Later in the show, Thane Maynard will tell us more about that. To start us off this afternoon, close to 800,000 Americans each year suffer a new or recurrent stroke. And while stroke is the fifth leading cause of death in the U.S., there are nearly 7 million stroke survivors in the U.S. Joining us to discuss the causes, the risks, and the treatments for stroke are neurointensivist Dr. Ope Adeowe, Medical Director of the University of Cincinnati Medical Center Health Telestroke Program, Dr. Brian Katz, Neurologist and Vascular Neurology Fellow in the UC Medical Center Department of Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine, and Cindy Werner, a Senior Clinical Research Coordinator with the UC Stroke Team. You can join the conversation today at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Ope, start off by telling us, what exactly is a stroke?
Well, I guess the most important thing to consider is that for people who have a sudden change in their status, we're concerned that they may be having a stroke. And by status, I mean all of a sudden you're not moving an arm, all of a sudden you can't speak, all of a sudden your face is droopy. And there's an acronym called FAST, which is Face, Arm, Speech, and Time. And for us, that's the first message we want to get out, is that for somebody whose face droops all of a sudden, their arm isn't working, their speech is slurred, or they can't get their words out, the first thing we'd ask is for those people to call 911, which is where the T comes from, is the time. So face, arm, speech, time, and time to call 911 if you have any of those symptoms. Having said that, the question is, what is a stroke? And there are two types of strokes primarily. The first is bleeding into the brain, causing damage to that part of the brain, and in so doing, affecting the opposite side of the body most of the time. The other part is where you can't get blood flow to a region of the brain. So loss of blood flow also can cause similar symptoms to bleeding into the same type of the brain, if we think about it as damage to the brain either way.
So this is actually, Brian, would you describe this as a brain attack? I think sometimes people confuse strokes and heart attacks. They think they're coming from the same place. They're not, are they?
So that's a great point. Strokes are not heart attacks, and from many different perspectives. And what is emphasized with the brain attack is the importance of the emergency and the fact that one shouldn't ignore their symptoms or be fearful or try to be in denial of it. And so although brain attack has been used as a term to try to sometimes try to replace a stroke, the point of a brain attack, or the term of it, is that the brain is being damaged. And if you're experiencing any of the symptoms as previously described, as a facial droop, arm weakness, abnormal speech, that sense of emergency or that attack should be is reinforced with that. So you should call 911. So it's some have replaced the term for in the general population for as a brain attack as such, and it's to emphasize the emergency and how this is a potential intervenable treatment, intervenable disorder that has treatments and prevention that goes along with it.
So, Cindy, it sounds like time really is of the essence, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The sooner you can get treatment, the better your outcomes, for sure.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And how do strokes affect the body? I guess, as you were saying, Ope, it depends on which part of the brain it occurs in.
So, yes, in general terms, if the right side of the brain is affected by a stroke, the left side of the body is generally not working, for lack of a better description. Similarly, if the left side of the brain is affected, the right side of the body may not be working. Now, again, depending on what part of the brain is involved, you may have speech difficulties on top of that, namely slurring speech, as well as not being able to actually get words out that one is trying to get out, and sometimes not being able to understand spoken speech from somebody else.
What about vision problems? Are those a common occurrence when you're having a stroke?
That certainly also occurs, and there's the possibility of not being aware that one is having vision problems.
Really?
you could begin to compensate for the fact that you can't see one half of your world by contorting your body a little bit so that you get by, but don't actually realize that there's a problem in as much as you can't see one side or the other.
Brian, did you want to add to that?
excuse me. The brain is an amazing eloquence organ that is very complex. And with that, the hallmarks of it that we want to enforce is the sudden onset of these lack of symptoms. And it's hard to describe of any one particular unifying feature that's a stroke. But the majority of strokes that we see do involve the face, the arm, and speech. And that's why we reinforce that with the acronym of FAST. And, but the hallmark being that it's the sudden onset of the lack of those symptoms. Strokes can, because the brain's so eloquent, strokes can do anything per se, but it's that sudden onset of those symptoms that's the doctors are concerned about.
So we're talking about like a full-blown stroke, but there are also, what, TIAs that are called mini strokes as well? What can you tell me about those?
Yeah, so those are, TIA stands for transient ischemic attack, and the term mini stroke, I would suggest, is probably a bit of a misnomer, mm-hmm. and I would urge that we not think in those terms, actually.
Because it's a serious thing.
Because it's a serious thing, and even in the context of somebody having a quote-unquote mild stroke, what we find is that 3 months later, a third of those people that had quote-unquote mild stroke, we're not even talking mini strokes now, we're talking what we would otherwise consider a relatively mild stroke, a third of those people aren't able to go back to work and aren't functioning at their highest levels 3 months later. To dwell on the TIA specifically a little bit, again, this is an instance where somebody has the sudden onset loss of function that we've been discussing, and then they regain function. So your arm isn't working 1 second, you're aware of it, then all of a sudden, it's working again and you seem to be fine. Unfortunately, a lot of people try to sleep those things off, and a lot of people wait to see if it'll go away.
Or they might just say, it went away, so I don't have to worry about it.
Right. Yeah. And what we would like to convey is that when you get that, there's actually an opportunity here to have you not be permanently damaged. So if somebody has a TIA, it's still an emergency because now you're back to yourself and the options are that you stay yourself or that you don't. And if you don't seek care, you increase the likelihood that you in fact commit yourself to permanent damage in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, you could be subjecting yourself to possible disability.
Yes. So there's actually a window where if you have that TIA and your symptoms are gone, I would think of that as, it seems like I should get some help because that's not something I want to come back.
You know, is there pain involved in this? Is a lot of this that people just ignore the pain or?
So I'm an emergency physician and it's difficult because in the context of trauma, we see a lot of trauma, and you can imagine how dramatic it can be sometimes when there's bleeding and there's pain and there's broken bones and those sorts of things. Whereas in the context of stroke, I've just said people aren't moving and people aren't speaking. And so even if there's some discomfort, which I've never had a stroke, so I can't speak to whether or not there's some discomfort, but there's not overt pain for the majority of stroke. And so when people aren't speaking and people aren't moving, there's a tendency for us all to not be as attuned to the emergency that faces us as we should be.
Cindy, you're involved with UC Stroke Team. Now, tell me about that. That sounds like that's almost one of those time is of the essence kind of groups.
Absolutely. The UC Stroke Team is, around 20 physicians and around 10 coordinators. And we go to the greater Cincinnati area to, we respond to the strokes. And that's very important to mention here because the UC Stroke Team, if you have a stroke and you present to like, out in, I don't know,
Any hospital in the region.
Yeah. I can't think. Like Ridge or something, or out in Western Hills, and you respond to those hospitals, you'll see the ER physician, but then they will call the stroke team, and our physicians will respond to those calls, and we manage those patients.
Okay, so this is a team of experts. You can work with any patient, any hospital. Is
that right, in the greater Cincinnati area. Yeah.
And Opwa, you're working with Telestroke, which is similar to the stroke team, in that you're dealing with outlying hospitals and people in rural areas, right?
Correct. So if I may just add to what Cindy said a second ago. So the one I should say that everybody listening should really be very proud of the system that we have in place in the greater Cincinnati region. So the UC stroke team has been around for 30 years, and we have covered every hospital in the region for 30 years by phone, in person, or in the past 3-4 years by telemedicine, which is what you were referring to, Mark. So the places within the Beltway we generally are driving to in person. Historically, the places outside of the Beltway we have received calls from and done the best we can with what we get over the phone. In the context of the evolution of technology the past 5 years or so, we began doing telemedicine at those places outside of the Beltway for the most part, because again, we're able to provide in-person care at the hospitals within the Beltway. And then with regard to telemedicine specifically, we've just mentioned how time is brain, and the faster we treat, the faster the patient does, the faster the patient recognizes that, or somebody else recognizes that there's a stroke going on, the faster they arrive at the hospital, which reduces the time from the onset of the symptoms to when they actually get treatment. Along those lines, then, the options are that I get in my car and I start driving to wherever, or that I'm able to, in today's day and age, do the equivalent of FaceTime, take a look, make a decision, and get the patient treated, even if I then still have to go over. I'm saving whatever the travel time is, and everybody knows what happens on 71, 75 this time of year. And so between now and the fall, we get into this place where we're scurrying around town trying to navigate our way through traffic and construction. But we've been able to use telemedicine to augment care and get care delivered to the stroke patient faster.
Right. It goes back to the idea that time is of the essence. Is there some level of robotics that you're using with the telestroke program?
So we have two partners. One is an established partner at the facilities outside of farther out, about 45 minutes in any direction. And in that instance, there are sort of high fidelity devices and robots and machines. They're not something that we're controlling or driving through hallways, for instance, mm-hmm. but they certainly are impressive to look at and able to zoom in and zoom out.
So it can help you with the exam, so you can take a closer look
at
the patient.
Absolutely.
Okay. We will continue our conversation about strokes, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss the causes, risks, and treatments for stroke are neurointensivist Dr. Opwa Adeyewe, who's the medical director of the University of Cincinnati Medical Center Health Telestroke Program, Dr. Brian Katz, neurologist and vascular neurology fellow in the UC Medical Center Department of Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine, and Cindy Werner, a senior clinical research coordinator with the UC Stroke Team. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And what are some of the risk factors for stroke? Brian?
So there are several risk factors for stroke, and it's hard to conceptualize all of them, although some are more important than others. By far and large, some of the most important ones is hypertension. And a lot of Americans suffer from hypertension, and it's a painless disorder. And so a lot of times we neglect to address that as necessary. But over years, it really wreaks havoc on your blood vessels, and stroke is a disorder of those blood vessels. And if controlling one's hypertension is a great way to really prevent your risk from having strokes in the future. The other major one that, as Americans, we can battle is stopping smoking. And that, too, not only affects your heart and your lungs, but also affects your blood vessels as well. And once again, stroke is a disorder of those blood vessels. There's several other ones, but those are the two major ones that I usually emphasize with my patients that I see. Any other ones that you guys feel?
Hyperlipidemia, of course, mm-hmm. and obesity.
Hyperlipidemia, high cholesterol, in other words? Okay,
yes.
Yeah, obesity.
The only thing I would add to what Brian said with regard to high blood pressure and hypertension is, you know, I think the numbers are about 80 million Americans have high blood pressure. And of those that have high blood pressure, 80% actually know they have high blood pressure. So one in five of the people that have high blood pressure are walking around not knowing that they have high blood pressure.
Really?
And then of the people that do know they have high blood pressure, I don't know I think it's about half are actually mm-hmm. taking medicine for it.
Mm-hmm.
Of the people that are taking medicine, only about half actually have control of their blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how the risk sort of piles up, even at every level. And I suspect that many people who are listening right now, one, may suspect they have high blood pressure, aren't sure. Two, they know they have high blood pressure. They know it's terribly controlled, but they're not doing anything about it, or they're not actively engaged in trying to improve that. Two is, okay, so I'm taking my pills, but it's still not controlled.
It's not getting me anywhere.
And it's not getting me anywhere, so I'm just going to stop and so on and so forth. And so I think that if there's any points that I would make, it's that there is a threat to your health, and I can't overstate that. There's a threat to your health with regard to high blood pressure. It's painless, as Brian mentioned, so it's difficult to convey that to people. Again, in the emergency department, we see this all the time. People come in because, name it, you know, something itches.
Mm-hmm.
And the itching is an emergency. And by God, I must be seeing at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning or something. But they come in and their blood pressure is through the roof. And you spend time saying, do you realize that your blood pressure is as high as it is and you need to address that? And try to emphasize how big a threat this is to overall health, not just strokes, but heart attacks and other matters.
Absolutely.
Yeah. High blood pressure affects a lot of things. I mean, even kidneys and other body functions. Yeah. So you're right about that. Let's talk with Joanne in Centerville. Hi, Joanne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your question?
My question has to do with something that I read. There is a connection that there is. Stating that there is a connection between treatment of depression and increased risk in stroke. Is there any truth to this?
Okay, so is there a link with stroke and depression? Brian?
So that's a good question. It's unclear, and there's no clear risk as much as high blood pressure or smoking or hyperlipidemia. We do know that depression after a stroke can decrease your rate of rehabilitation. But having depression before a stroke or the treatments before having depression or the treatments of the depression, I'm not clear that's a clear risk for having a stroke. And I would not, if you have depression, I would seek treatment for it, and I would pursue treatment or not avoid treatment because of the risk of stroke. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. If I understand correctly, too, you're saying this is more likely to affect your outcome after the
Correct.
Stroke, how you rehabilitate.
Correct.
Your outlook affects how you come back from it. Okay. What about heredity? Does that play a factor in strokes, Opwe?
Well, it certainly does, and a lot of that relates to the risk factors that we've already alluded to. So, you know, people who are hypertensive, that certainly is something that passes from generation to generation. People who are diabetic, as something that passes from generation to generation. So there is a, there's an element of heredity to stroke also.
And it's not only a genetic factor, it's also a social factor. We learn from our parents and our siblings. And so meaning that if you are able to address these lifestyle issues and able to combat hypertension, smoking, and so forth, that also may have effects not only for you, but also generations to come.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's talk with Elizabeth in Middletown. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I have a question.
Go right ahead.
Yes. 5 years ago, mother had a devastating stroke involving the brainstem, and she was actually in the Middletown Hospital at the time. She had been in the hospital for 5 days stabilizing from a heart murmur. She was 83, had hypertension, obesity, diabetes, and it just seems a shame. I mean, she was in the hospital, and I just wonder how that gets missed. The same thing happened to a cousin's grandmother. She had been in the hospital as a patient and had a stroke while in there, and that was my question.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Yeah, a lot of the risk factors you just described, those are all things you'd be looking for, right, as signs that you could be at risk of having a stroke.
So, Elizabeth, thank you very much for putting me on the spot there. unfortunately, I mean, I think the bottom line is it's a bit of a shame that for us as health providers, it's a bit of a shame that the grocery store is a much better place to have a stroke than the hospital sometimes. And a big part of that is being seen when somebody actually notices that, oh, that person was walking along and then they stopped walking along. Whereas in the hospital, depending on your level of acuity, where either have you in the ICU where you're being bugged every half hour to every hour, or we have you on the regular floors where you may not be seen for 4 hours at least, you have a different level of care. So if we think about it as there's nobody checking in on this person every half hour, we'll miss a window of treatment for stroke. We've alluded to how important it is to treat somebody quickly for stroke. We haven't mentioned so far that we do have a limited time window to administer some of the treatments we have. The two treatments we have are a medication called TPA, which is a clot busting medication, and the second is an angiogram, endovascular therapy. So doing an angiogram for somebody who has a big clot there that we can go retreat. And Cindy, I don't know if you want to speak to the issue of last normal time.
Well, hang on just a second here. And we are talking about strokes, what causes them, how to treat them with neurointensivist Dr. Opwe Adeyewe, Medical Director of the University of Cincinnati Medical Center Health Telestroke Program. Dr. Brian Katz, he's a neurologist and vascular neurology fellow in the UC Medical Center Department of Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine. And Cindy Werner, a senior clinical research coordinator with the UC Stroke Team. And thanks to Steve Grout for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. And Cindy, go ahead.
Yes. So as a member of the UC Stroke Team, when we come to a hospital to in response to a consult call, one of the first questions that we ask is, what time was this patient last seen normal? Or when was the last known well time? And that's a critical piece of information that we need obtained from the family, next of kin, whoever saw them. We have looked in pockets for receipts at the grocery store to see. There's so many ways we've dug into actually finding out when the last known well time was. We've become pretty creative and inventive in our trying to find that critical piece of information. And the reason why is because that starts the clock of treatment. So as Dr. Adeyewe said, we have 3 hours to give the TPA, up to 4.5 hours to give the clot-busting TPA drug to help dissolve the clot that caused the stroke.
How effective is TPA?
That's another big question. In general, when I'm talking to patients and families, what I say is TPA can do one of three things. One is not much. Two is get you a little bit better in terms of the likelihood of independence in 3 months, which is really what we're shooting for. We would love to say that you have a better outlook at 3 months than you would have without the TPA. And the faster we give it, the better people do. So some of the limitations we observe with regard to TPA relate to some of the processes of the hospital and some of the processes of getting patients into the hospital as quickly as possible. And so I would say that the goal is to reduce disability with TPA. It's not a panacea, honestly. But having said that, it's still the best that we have to try and give people the best shot at doing better down the line.
How accessible is TPA? Is that available pretty much everywhere? Or?
It's available at every hospital in this region, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And in other regions of the country, people may need the telemedicine support. But even if they don't have the experts in the hospital to provide in-person care, they'll have the medication in their pharmacy.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Carol in Columbia Township. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm calling to find out or have some comments on the fact that both my husband and I have had strokes. We are both in excellent health. We have very good blood pressure, excellent cholesterol. We've always exercised faithfully. Neither one of us are overweight. And it's just very puzzling that we have both had strokes. When you tell all the things that we're supposed to be doing, and we do, and we still have a stroke. And I just wonder if you have any comments on that.
Okay, Carol, thank you.
Well, okay. This is more of my expertise as the neurology and the vascular neurology physician. So that's a great question. Now, strokes are we call it a heterogeneous disorder, meaning that lots of reasons can cause strokes. Now, if you look at the population as a whole, the vast majority of risk factors are the high blood pressure, the diabetes, the smoking cessation, the lack of exercise. That's absolutely true, and that's how we can help the masses as a whole to reduce their risk. Now, that being said, every single patient should be individualized, assessed, and especially if you're having an ischemic stroke, if you're having strokes despite having normal risk factors, that can still happen, and that's a very real possibility. But that also means that more personalized evaluations need to occur, and that's what certain neurologists and other physicians do as a subspecialty. So although my condolences go out to the fact you've had your strokes, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not doing anything wrong. It just means that I think further evaluation needs to occur, and there are doctors that are specialized in that to hopefully answer those questions that you and your husband are seeking.
And Brian, does the impact of strokes vary by gender and by race? Does it affect men more than women and certain races more than others?
That's a excellent question. The short answer is it affects both men and women equally, and it affects both whites and African Americans about the same incidence. However, the recovery of it is different, and typically in the blood clot strokes, it's in African Americans. They have more disabling deficits afterwards and not as much recovery. However, if the bleeding strokes, it does technically happen more frequently in African Americans, but they have better recovery than whites. The short answer, though, is there's a lot of questions that we don't have great answers for. And that's what part of the UC stroke team does, is that we do research to try to figure out these answers that we have. It's an evolving process without clear answers, but we're trying to get there.
We'll continue our conversation and take your phone calls at 513-419-7100. Later in the show, the Cincinnati Opera and the Cincinnati Zoo are reuniting. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We're talking with neurointensivist Dr. Opwe Adeyewe, Medical Director of the University of Cincinnati Medical Center Health Telestroke Program, Dr. Brian Katz, Neurologist and Vascular Neurology Fellow in the UC Medical Center Department of Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine, and Cindy Werner, a Senior Clinical Research Director with the UC Stroke Team. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Keith in Union, Kentucky. Hi, Keith.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great program. Real quick, what does the team there recommend if somebody recognizes somebody's had a stroke by the symptoms, or most likely have made the emergency call? And what's to be done to help mitigate or stabilize in that period of time before getting care? I'll take my the answer off the air. Appreciate the program.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you very much for that question, Keith. The bottom line, I think, is making that emergency call is by far and away the most critical thing that there is to do. For non-medical personnel, I would say that there's not really much else to do, because in our region, anywhere from Florence, where Keith is, through Fairfield, you know, you will get emergency response to you within 5 minutes or so. And so the primary thing is calling 911 and getting that person along the line towards care.
You know, I think something that the family could play a more active role in helping prevent a stroke, couldn't they? You know, and making sure that the person who is might have a high risk of having a stroke is making those lifestyle adjustments that they need to make.
Absolutely.
And to add on about what you can do if you see a family member or somebody having a stroke, I see a lot of patients in my clinic ask, you know, that for heart attacks, we give aspirin, or for seizures, we do certain things. So because there's many types of strokes, including bleeding strokes and clotting strokes, just to reinforce, call 911 and just support your friend or family member. Please don't give any medications or place them in any positions. Just be with them, prevent any falls, and just be with them. And that way, when the emergency medical providers can come, there's additional history that people can give. And trust me, that's worth its weight in gold.
Well, that's interesting, too, because you were talking about not giving any kind of medication. They talk about with a heart attack, taking aspirin. But with a stroke, no. I take it nothing.
The concern is that if you put an aspirin in the mouth, it's going to go down to the lungs if somebody can't swallow.
Okay.
And so we like to avoid the pneumonia if we can, because all those things contribute to the complications. And Brian sort of jarred my brain awake a little bit. So the other thing that I would add with regard to what the family member or bystander can do is to be aware of time, such that we can say explicitly, going back to Cindy's comments earlier, I last saw this person at this time, and then they collapsed, or their speech slurred, or their arm stopped working, and be able to feed that to the paramedics and or come along with them. So now we're trying to avoid that bystander, the only true witness. As you might imagine, by the time patients get to the emergency department, we're trying to piece together a story, and piecing together that story becomes way easier if the person who made the 911 call is physically there saying, this is what I saw and this is what happened.
Yeah, Roz emailed us and she asked if we could explain again the acronym FAST. Who wants to take that on? Cindy?
Sure. FAST. The F stands for face. And so a symptom would be an uneven facial expression or a facial droop. If you ask the person to smile, their one side might be droopy or the other. Ask them to raise their eyebrows and they may be uneven. The A is for arm. And if you hold both your arms out straight in front with your palms facing down, one may drift down or they may not even be able to raise their arm. Speech is the third one. And that would be if you had slurred speech or you're unable to speak or you couldn't comprehend. And then the T and FAST is time. And that's time to call 911, time to get to the hospital.
Yeah, which, as we've been emphasizing, that's probably the most crucial letter in that whole acronym is the T.
Correct. In addition, the FAST is the official American Stroke Association endorsement for recognizing the signs and symptoms of stroke. So if you go to the American Stroke Association website or just Yahoo, Google that, search engine, whatever you want, you'll be able to find that as well as associated pictures to help you identify that from a, learning from a different point of view.
Yeah, I saw the one lady, she did the selfie. Mm-hmm. And so she looked in her phone and took a picture of herself and she saw her facial droop and called 911. She
was, selfie really worked out well there.
Worked for her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk with Mickey in East End. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, it's me again.
Well, good to hear from you, Mickey. What's your question?
Hello. Sort of a statement question. I had a stroke, what appeared to be a stroke, in October of 2014 by myself. And what happened was I was just getting up very slowly, and I'm not fat. I don't smoke. I have none of the risk factors the previous caller mentioned. It was unexpected totally. I fell down. I just dropped to the floor, and I crashed against some wood, and it woke me up while I was unconscious. My eyes flung open, and for 45 seconds, I didn't know who I was, where I was. I thought I could pass my hands through the wall. I didn't know what was going on, and I finally came out of it, and I'd hurt my arm a little. That was okay. Additionally, I went to a neurologist in this city, in a particular hospital, in the first month of this year. And with this information and with a new MRI from a previous meningioma tumor that I'd had to check on it, and there were five new white lesions of white matter on my MRI. And his diagnosis to me was self-fulfilling prophecy, and that I was a spiritual radical. And it's kind of hard to trust one's doctors these days. I appreciate the program that you all are trying to put in place.
Sure, and let's let Dr. Adeaway say something about that, Mickey. Thank you.
Mickey, sorry to hear about your experience. And I think, I can't speak to the details of the MRI and what the doctor's diagnosis was, but I do think the larger issue of being able to reliably communicate to doctors and have us in a compassionate way respond to the patient's concerns is a bigger issue than we're talking about today. But I'll just say I wish you the best. I think that's a difficult place to be.
How are we doing? Are we making good progress on dealing with strokes? Is this vastly improved from what it was years ago?
So that's a great question. And we are improving in some ways, as well as staying the same, if not worsening in other ways. In regards to the last 10, 15 years, we have made improvements, not only with different ways we can treat patients with stroke that come in within a certain time, but also treating the complications of stroke at certain types of hospitals that are designed for strokes. So that being said, if you have a stroke and you're not within that time window for that special medication, there's still ways that we could treat treat with hospitals and medications to prevent any complications from strokes. Ways that we're potentially getting worse is that we've also times to getting from symptom onset to the ER has actually been shown to be a little bit worsening over the past few years. And that's one of the reasons why we want to enforce time is brain.
Well, thanks everybody for being here this afternoon.
Thanks,
Mark. Thank
you, Mark.
Neurointensivist Dr. Opwe Adeaway, Medical Director of the University of Cincinnati Medical Center Health Telestroke Program. Dr. Brian Katz, Neurologist and Vascular Neurology Fellow in the UC Medical Center Department of Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine. Cindy Werner, a Senior Clinical Research Coordinator with the UC Stroke Team.